Now, there's a link, should be a link to these notes right there in the study. But those of you that are on Facebook, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com and you click on this lesson from lesson 130, then the notes are right down here for this lesson, for lesson 130. So right now we're in lesson 131, and we're about halfway through this. We didn't finish it 3 weeks ago, and then we had some technical problems. So those of you that are joining us, I need you to find page 4, and we're right here on page 4 in this discussion about 1 Samuel, okay, chapter 24. So if you guys recall, what we were doing last time is we were looking at the, we're studying the Geneva Bible, the 1560 Geneva Bible, as a precursor to the King James, and we were discussing the Old Testament. This is our third study looking at the Old Testament of the 1560 Geneva Bible. And the reason we're doing that is because it's the first English Bible to translate the entire Old Testament out of Hebrew. So we've studied in the past how William Tyndale, before he died, he was able to do Genesis through Deuteronomy. He was able to do Joshua through 2 Chronicles and the book of Jonah, but that none of the other Bibles until the Geneva Bible of 1560 were able to translate, or did translate, the rest of the Old Testament. Okay, so in the middle of this conversation, we were looking at what we were talking about was examples from the Geneva Bible of how they handled the text. Okay, so the verse that we are talking about, or that we were really discussing, is this verse right here. Okay, so if you will open your King James Bible to 1 Samuel 24, the verse we're talking about is this verse right here in 1 Samuel chapter 24. And if you remember, we had some confusion a few weeks back because there is a verse numbering difference between the King James and the Geneva Bible at this verse. Okay? So find in your King James Bible with me 1 Samuel 24. And in our Bible, in the Bible that we read from, it's going to be verse 3 if my memory is correct. It's verse 3, but in the Geneva Bible is verse 4. So there was some confusion last time. Remember, I think it was Ernie who kind of figured that out, that the confusion was coming from a difference in the numbering of the verses. Okay, so what we were talking about was in the Geneva Bible how sometimes they put the literal Hebrew in the text, in the actual text, and then in the margin they will explain it in English. And then how other times they put the literal, they put an English equivalent into the text, and then they give the literal Hebrew in the margin. So we were talking about how it goes both ways, okay? And we were using Hammond's work in the making of the English Bible to kind of frame this discussion. And we got to this example here in 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 4 in the Geneva Bible, verse 3 in the King James. So let's just take stock of what we were talking about as a way to kind of get this conversation rolling again after a little bit of a break, an unanticipated break. So here's the Geneva Bible, okay? In verse 4 it says, "And he came to the sheep coats by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to do his easement. And David and his men sat in the inward parts of the cave," right? So there's a marginal note here on this statement right here, "to do his easement," where the literal Hebrew is given to you in the margin where it says to cover his feet. Okay? If you look in your King James Bible in verse 3, so again, there's the numbering difference, verse 3, "And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave." All right? So the King James takes or uses the literal Hebrew idiom that is found in the margin of the Geneva Bible and places it into the main text of the King James Bible. Right? How many remember when we talked about that? Okay? Then, because of what Hammond says in the notes here on the middle of page 4, we kind of got into a secondary conversation about what does it mean to cover his feet, right? And we had some discussion about that, about whether that means to take a nap or whether that means to relieve yourself, to cover your feet in the process of relieving yourself, or as they eloquently say, doing your easement. All right. So we had some conversation about that, and then we kind of ran out of time a few weeks back. And then Mike has sent me some things, and Amy made some comments on a post on Facebook and a couple other things, right? But it was actually Ken, if you remember, who brought up, is this where David encounters Saul when he's sleeping? And according to, you know, the way Ken had been taught it by all the blue-haired ladies in Sunday school when he was growing up, as was I, that this was him sleeping, right? That Saul sleeping and David comes in and cuts off the skirt of his robe in the next verse, etc., right? And so we were having a conversation about whether or not that's what's going on here. So come with me to chapter 26 of 1 Samuel. Just turn with me to chapter 26. Now, this is not something that I'm willing to have like a major argument over and like divide the church and all this sort of stuff. But I will tell you just flat out, after looking at this, I do think that this is talk, that the expression to cover his feet is talking about the relieving of his bodily function, not sleeping. Okay? I'll give you a few reasons for that. Okay? One of them is there is another story where David comes upon Saul while he's sleeping in chapter 26 of 1 Samuel. Okay? So, let's look at this, and we want verse 7. And David and Abiathar, however you say that name, came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench. So, in this case, is he clearly sleeping? Yes. Within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abiathar to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. So what's this guy saying? Pick up the spear and let's just skewer him to the earth right now and be done. That's basically what he's saying. That's the Ross version of what he's saying. Okay. And David said to Abiathar, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? So David, this is actually the second time that David sort of has Saul under the knife, where he could easily dispatch of him, and he decides what? Not to. Okay, so if you drop down to verse, so David says, no, we can't do that. It's not the right thing to do. Drop down to verse 12, and David took the spear and the curse of water from Saul's bolster, that they got away, that no man saw it nor knew it, neither awakened, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep was fallen. From the Lord was fallen upon them. And David went over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill afar off, and a great space between them. And David cried to the people and Abner the son, saying, "Answerest thou not, Abner?" Then Abner answered, and then David has this conversation with him and says, basically, "Look, I could have what? I could have killed you, but I what?" So there is an account here, two chapters later, where David does come upon Saul while he's what? Sleeping. Okay, so the question then is, what is this talking about then? Go back to chapter 24. What does this expression mean when it talks about to cover his feet? Okay, so let's look at a couple things about this. So first of all, again, remember that literal Hebrew is in the margin of the Geneva Bible. And it ends up where? In the main text reading of the King James Bible. Okay? So, let me switch this up. Let's go look at a couple other things. So, here is the verse in the Geneva Bible. And he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to do his easement, and David and his men sat in the inward parts of the cave. Okay? So, I want to look at a couple things here related to this first. So, let's go back and look at Coverdale. Now, Coverdale is not translating from Hebrew. He's translating either from German or from Latin. Okay? So let's look at what he did with that verse. Then said David unto him, lo this, so you can see a difference in wording here. And I think I need verse 4 again, maybe. Hang on. Let's go to previous verse. And when he came to the sheepfolds by the way, there was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet. But David and his men sat behind him in the cave. So what's interesting in this case is the Coverdale Bible is actually more in line with the literal Hebrew, because he's not getting it from the Hebrew, he's getting it from somebody else who translated the Hebrew literally. Probably either Luther or the Latin itself. Okay? But notice what it has. To cover his feet, right? So let's look at the Matthew Bible. You can see from these colors that I've already looked at this. If you look at the Matthew Bible, who's following Coverdale, and he came to the flocks of sheep by the wayside where was a cave, and Saul went in to what? To cover his feet. Okay? Great Bible, which is a revision of those previous two, what do you expect we're going to find? And he came in by the flocks away, and Saul went into the cave to what? To cover his feet. Then we know the Geneva. Let's just look at the Geneva again. And here's where it says, we actually have to go to the next verse in the Geneva for some reason because of their verse numbering. But it has to do with what? Easement. Now let's go back to the next verse and let's look at the, that's not what I wanted. I wanted previous verse. And we want the bishops. Notice what it says. That Saul went in to do his what? So, when we're thinking about what does this mean, we have to take into account, I think, a lot of information about what this might mean. Now, Mike Erspommer, he did a lot of, sent me a ton of stuff here, where he took some Bible search programs and stuff, and he looked at different commentaries and what different folks had to say about this. And I've read through this a couple different times, and the long and the short of it, to me, Mike, and you can chime in if you want, is that they're divided on what it means. Some think it means he's sleeping. Other people think it means what?
Relieving
himself. Okay? So, let's look at something else now. Any questions so far? So, in the King James, what verse is it? Is it verse 4?
3.
Okay. First Samuel 3, right? All right, so we'll go to Blue Letter Bible and look at it. So here it is in the Blue Letter Bible, the King James, right? Here in the blue shading. And he came to the sheepcote by the way where it was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. So if you read down through the next verses, then they have a discussion. They're in the cave, and they have another discussion about what they're going to do, and they want to kill him then. And David says, no, we can't do that because he's the Lord's anointed. So he walks up and he cuts off a piece of the hem of Saul's skirt in this context here in this chapter. Okay, so we've already looked at two chapters later in chapter 26. He clearly does come upon Saul while he's sleeping, and they have a conversation about whether they should take the spear and what? And kill him, and then David eventually takes the spear and then announces, hey, listen, I could have killed you, but I didn't, etc. Okay? Now, I just want to look at this, and this is not in any way, shape, manner, or form to decide the matter, but I do think it is interesting. So one of the things I wanted to know then is, well, how do modern versions handle this reading? I wanted to look at it and see. So if we go to the NIV and just load it quickly, notice what it says. And he came to the sheep pens along the way, a cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So they clearly think it means what? To relieve yourself, right? Let's look at the ESV. Verse 3. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to do what? Now you'll notice there's a what? There's a footnote there, right? So let's look at that footnote, and what do they give as the literal Hebrew? To cover his feet. Okay? Now, for me, I'm not deciding this based upon the NIV and the ESV, but let's just take stock of what we have here. Do we have Coverdale? Do we have Coverdale, the Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, all saying cover his feet? Before the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible has to do his easement, and then in the margin it says cover his what? His feet. Bishops, same thing. The King James then says, no, using the principle of following the literal Hebrew, they have it as what?
Cover
his feet. Okay? So, let's do one more thing here on this. I'm going to search for the word cover, and I'm going to put in an asterisk, because so that'll find anything with the word what? Cover. And then I'm going to, some of you have seen David Reed do this, and I'm also going to put in the word feet, and let's see what, well, but I don't want ESV, I want King James, and let's see what we get. Okay, look at Judges chapter 3 verse 24. When he was gone out, his servants came, and when they saw that, behold, the doors of the parlor were locked, they said, surely he covereth his feet in the summer chamber. Okay, now that one sounds like somebody who's what? Sleeping. Right? Then we have the one we're looking at here, and then we have this one, and it's above it stood the seraphim, even one had six wings, with twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet. So that there it's being used to an angel covering his feet, to a seraphim covering his feet with a set of his what?
Wings.
Okay? And then here we have, one more time here in Ezekiel 24:17, forbear to cry, make no mourning for the dead, bind the tire of thine head upon thee, and put away thy shoes upon thy feet, and cover now thy lips, etc. So here, the structure is different, right? So he's going to put his shoes upon his feet and cover his lips. That's not even really talking about the same kind of thing, right? So those are the verses in the King James that have that expression, that have a form of cover and feet together in the same verse, okay? So, as I look at all of this, and as I think about all of this, I tend to think that, if you go all the way back now to 1 Samuel chapter 24, I tend to view the expression as an expression related to him doing his easement, if you will. Not that he's sleeping. And there's some of the stuff that Mike sent me, there's stuff that there's very strict rules in the law about where you can dig a latrine in relationship to the camp and all this sort of thing. So if they were camping in this area and Saul had to go, it makes perfect sense that he would go off by himself somewhere and do his easement away from the camp because of the law, the rules in the law about where you're supposed to have a latrine and all this sort of stuff in relationship to the camp. So that's my opinion. For what it's worth, I'm open to hearing what anyone else has to say.
And
yeah.
I'm wondering why the King James left it as is and didn't translate it as the Geneva Bible.
It's great.
This idiom is 1,500 years old. It's clearly, I don't think the English-speaking people of the day would understand an idiom that is 1,500 years old.
So you're saying it was 1,500 years old when they did?
When 1 Samuel was written.
Yeah. In relation to the King James.
Yeah. From the first English Bible, it's 1,500 years previous. Or more.
I'd probably be saying more than that, but yeah. So what? So.
So.
What's your? I'm not following your overall point.
So, you'd think the King James scholars would want the people to understand what that meant, but they chose to leave it as is, as the literal translation. Why? I wonder why.
Yeah.
Now,
interesting.
So there's not consensus. That's all you can say. And
yeah, I would say that would be fair. I mean, there definitely is not consensus as far as what the expression means. I tend to think it is related to the easement of a bodily function and not taking a nap, but that's my opinion, I suppose.
There are some famous scholars who think otherwise.
I would have to acknowledge that. Amy?
Well, it seems odd to me that anybody can be relieving themselves and have a bunch of people in a cave and not have a clue that somebody's cutting off a piece of your garment. And the other thing I was wondering is, did you look at uncovered?
Yeah, I did.
Because I mentioned something about that with Ruth and Goliath.
And it was uncover and feet, right?
Yeah.
I did look at that too, and let's look at that as well. So you're talking about these two here, right? So verse, go ahead, Amy.
I just
said yeah. So verse 4, and it shall be when he lieth down that thou shalt mark the place where he shall lie, and thou shalt go in and uncover his feet and lay thee down. So that's obviously talking about he's sleeping. I'm assuming Ruth goes in, uncovers his feet, and lies with him. At least that's why I understand that. Verse 7, and when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went in and lied down at the end of the heap of corn, and she came in softly and uncovered his feet and laid her down. So there's an argument for why cover his feet means to sleep, because the idea here is that Boaz is laying down to sleep and she has to uncover his feet, or in other words, lift up the blanket so that she can lie with him. That's what you're saying, right? I mean, so yeah, so I think that possibly the best we're going to be able to say here on this one is what Mike said, and that is that scholars are divided on it. Like I said, it's not something that I'm willing to, go die on a hill over, but it is an interesting conversation, I feel, as it relates to our English Bible and what's going on. And it's interesting to me, because when we first looked at this, I'll be honest with you, when we first looked at this, all I had done is look at the Geneva Bible, and I read what Hammond said about it. But then when I went back and I looked at what some of these other ones had to say, the Coverdale, Matthew, Great, Geneva Bishops, etc., and I saw that the Geneva wasn't even the first one, and the King James wasn't even the first one to have as its main text the idea of to cover his feet, I'm like, wow, Hammond never mentioned that. So, anyway, the whole reason we're talking about this is because of we were studying the Old Testament text of the Geneva Bible, and we were talking about how sometimes it'll have the English equivalent, like in this verse, to do with easement, and then the literal Hebrew will be in the margin, and then sometimes it's the opposite, like we saw in our previous study, lesson 130, where the literal Hebrew will be in the text and the margin will give an English equivalent. So sometimes it's vice versa in the Geneva Bible. Okay? Now, let's go back now to page 4. So, again, I think Amy raises some good points. I think Mike raised some good points. I'm not prepared to say one is definitively right over the other. Okay.
Other thing related to the garment, though, as far as cutting it off, did he have it on? Did he leave it 30 feet away and, go into his thing?
Well, I think that, to me, knowing how they dressed, and if he's got to take that stuff off to do his easement, I can conceive of it being laying there in a dark cave and somebody could cut the hem of it off without him knowing.
Or carry it away and bring it back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that happened. So, and I also think, like I said, if knowing what the law had to say also about like camps versus where you're supposed to do this kind of stuff, I think that is another valid point in the conversation, although I don't know that we're going to be able to determine it definitively. Okay? So, now where we kind of got off on this too is if you look at that middle paragraph. So let me show you the paragraph I'm talking about here in the notes now. So let me go back over here and call, nope, I want this. This paragraph starting right here at 1 Samuel 24, where we started this conversation. In 1 Samuel 24:4, the Geneva text says Saul has Saul going in to do his easement, but the Hebrew says, as Geneva's note has it, to cover his feet, i.e. to urinate. The literal idiom goes straight from Geneva margin into the authorized version's text. So my comment there is Geneva's not the first one to have that even in the margin, because the Coverdale, the Matthew's Bible, and the Great Bible all had to cover his feet before the Geneva Bible. Okay? So here's where we also got a little bit confused. This is not a matter of Geneva's greater delicacy. So it's not that they're like prudish and don't want to talk about bodily functions, if that is what it is. Obviously Hammond believes that that's what it is. Okay? This is not a matter of Geneva's greater delicacy. This is just its fear that the literal sense will not be understood. It is not loath later in 1 Samuel 25:2 to translate literally, "For truly I will not leave all that he hath by the dawning of the day, any that pisseth against the wall." So the point here is, are they so prudish that they're not going to use that word pisseth?
No.
No, they obviously use it, okay? So let's look at the King James on that verse. Go to 1 Samuel 25, verse 22. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 22. Notice what the King James says. It says, "So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave all that pertain to him by the morning light, any that what? Pisseth against the wall," right? So that the King James used the literal Hebrew there also. Okay, so the point here was simply to say that the Geneva's not trying to be like overly sensitive and delicate, but for some reason in that verse they give an English equivalent and they put the literal Hebrew in the margin. Now I will say this. Did they believe that Saul had some sort of bodily function going on here? The Geneva translators.
Yeah.
I would say they did think that by the way they render it to do his what? To do his easement. Okay? So we can move off of this, please. Can we move off of this? Okay? Let's move to the next example. In 1 Samuel 25:24, Abigail asked David if she may speak with him. As the Hebrew idiom has it, "in your ears." The Geneva Bible avoids the idiom, rendering it like this. "F thine handmaiden speak to thee with in thine ears," left in the marginal note. So let's look at that. We want to look now at the Geneva Bible, and we want chapter 25, right? And what verse?
24.
So that's convenient enough to look at. So here's the verse. And the part that we're looking at here is, "And I pray thee, let thine handmaid speak to thee, and hear thou the words of thine handmaid." Okay? So here's the marginal note, right? And the literal Hebrew is in the margin, and it says what? "In thine what? Ears." Let's go look at chapter 25, verse 24 in the King James. It says, "And fell on his feet and said, Upon me, my Lord, upon me let thine iniquity be, and let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine what?
Audience."
Okay? So there's a little bit of a slight, doesn't mention anything about ears, But you get the idea of it, okay? The Authorized Version tries to find an English equivalent without the unwarranted meaning of whispering, which is a literal rendering would unavoidably carry, let thine handmaid speak in thine audience. Something similar occurs later in the chapter in verse 35 when David tells her that he has heard her voice and has granted thy petition, or that at least in the Geneva rendering of the Hebrew phrase, in the margin it gives a literal translation of it, receive thy face. And the Authorized Version finds an English equivalent with some sense of the original idiom, I have hearkened to thy voice and have accepted thy person. Person here has the sense of countenance or face, an idiom going back by way of Coverdale to the Vulgate, to the Septuagint. So in other words, sometimes they're doing this in a strictly literal way, other times they're giving English equivalents in the margin, in the main text of the Geneva Bible, and then they're leaving the margin to give the literal Hebrew equivalent, okay? And sometimes the King James is kind of like walking a line between the two by being as literal as they can be, but still making sense in what? In English, is the point that he's making here, okay? So, one final example denotes the contrast between Geneva's unwillingness to introduce Hebrew idiom and the Authorized Version's readiness to do so. In Joshua chapter 14, verse 11, Caleb, a man 85 years old, claims to be as strong as he was 40 years earlier when Moses employed him as one of the Israelite spies. In the Geneva Bible's rendering, his claim is a double one, both as a fighting man and a man of peacetime. And this is what it has. Quote, as strong as I was then, so strong am I now, either for war or for government. But the note to government reveals that the literal meaning of the Hebrew is to go out and come in. In effect, what the translators have done is what modern translators often feel they have to do, that is to interpret the idiom rather than reproduce it. In the Authorized Version, the reader is left to make his own interpretation of what the phrase might mean. Quote, as my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war, both to go out and to come in. So let's look at that quick in the King James. So that would be Joshua chapter 14. Joshua chapter 14. Joshua chapter 14, verse 11. So you'll see that the King James retains the literal Hebrew idiom in this verse. Verse 11, And yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day Moses sent me, as my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war, both to go out and to come in. So there's a little bit of ambiguity in the English, in that statement in English, but the King James retains the literal Hebrew idiom in this verse. And lo and behold, once again, it would be the same idiom found in the margin where? Of the Geneva Bible. Okay? So, let's go to page 5 and move on with this. I know everyone's bored now, okay? So, sorry about that. All right. In the next category of examples, Hammond is much more positive of how the Geneva translators use the marginal notes to explain the intricacies of the Hebrew text to the English reader. Quote, the desire to interpret is the key to the Geneva translation. So far I have tended to stress its negative implications, but it has positive ones too. The examples I have given have largely shown up the use of its marginal notings of the literal Hebrew to justify an interpretive translation. But in its more discursive notes, we begin to see the basis for its success in gripping the minds of four generations of English readers. Most importantly, the marginal note could be used to support pithy or powerfully vague renderings. In Job 9:24, for instance, the briefest note fills out the text. Here the Geneva Bible translates absolutely literally as follows. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If not, where is he or who is he? So let's go to the King James. Let's get Job chapter 9, verse 24. Job chapter 9, verse 24. So let's compare what we just read there with what the King James says. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If not, where and who is he? As far as I could tell, that's pretty near identical. Right? So let's read on the notes. In the margin, as the note to where is he, is the explanation quote that can show the country. For a modern version intent on avoiding all vagueness, the final phrases are untranslatable, and the New English Bible accordingly leaves them out. They just leave it out because they can't come up with something in English that is remotely close to what it says in the Hebrew, so they just say what? Don't need it. Obviously a decision I don't agree with. For a modern version, I already read that. So Job 32, verses 21 through 22, the Hebrew uses the verb kenah twice. The Authorized Version translated it rather windily as giving flattering titles to. Geneva is more pithy. Geneva says, I will not now accept the person of man, neither will I give titles to man. So that would be verse 21, and then verse 22, for I may not give titles, lest my Maker should take me away suddenly. The note to titles justifies the pithiness by explaining the Hebrew word signifieth to change the name, as to call a fool a wise man, meaning that he would not cloak the truth to flatter men. So this is an example then of where they're using the margin to do what? This is an example of where the Geneva is using their marginal notes to explain the literalness that they have, the Hebrew literalness that they have in the English text. Okay? The fine example occurs in Ruth 4:1, where the Hebrew uses the phrase roughly equivalent to the English, so-and-so. Geneva translates it tersely, how such one come, sit down here. Adding in the margin, the Hebrews here use two words which have no proper signification, but seem to note a certain person, as we say, ho Sarah or ho such a one. So in other words, what the Geneva's doing, again, is it's trying to maintain as much Hebrew literalness as it can while using the margin to explain. Occasionally, the scholarship of the Geneva translators is used to give more substance to the actual Hebrew text. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 6, for example, they translate the Hebrew accurately, and they gathered together the mitzvah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord. Then in the margin, they give the reader the explanation of the Aramaic phrase, the Targum, and this is what they say in the margin, the Chaldee text hath that they draw water out of their heart that is wept abundantly for their sins. The context is that of the repentant Israelites' journeying to make battle with the Philistines. The Geneva note sees every action on this journey as having a symbolic force. So all of that, let's just finish this quote. The Geneva note then could aid a translation, which reproduced the ellipses and ambiguities of the original. This help is most effective in passages of biblical poetry, as we shall see shortly, but it also works in narrative contexts. In 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 7, the pure sarcasm of Jezebel's taunt to her husband over his failure to secure Naboth's vineyard is perfectly conveyed in the Geneva rendering, quote, "Then Jezebel, his wife, said unto him, Dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel?" And in the margin for the, quote, simpler souls who do not see the point of the question is the explanation, quote, "As though she said, Thou knowest not what it is to reign, command that thou command and entreat not." So you see what the margin's doing there. Is the margin explaining the text to the English reader? Okay? Now look at the English Bible's flattening out of the sarcasm in order that its readers may understand the point. Quote, "Are you or are you not king in Israel?" said Jezebel. Let's go to that verse. Go to 1 Kings in your Bible. Go to 1 Kings chapter 21. You need to understand, when Jezebel says that to him, is she like sticking it to him? She's sticking it to him, right? Taunting him almost. 1 Kings 21:7. "And Jezebel his wife said unto him, Dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel?" I mean, what's she saying to him when she says that?
You know what you're doing?
Are you a king or aren't you?
Not? Are you a king or aren't you, man?
Are you crazy?
Are you a baby? Are you? What is going on here with you?
Get with the program.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So, the Geneva Bible, let's go back. So, the Geneva Bible said, in that rendering, "Then Jezebel his wife said unto him, Dost thou now govern the kingdom of Israel?" It's very similar to what the King James has, is it not? And then in the margin, it said, as the explanation, "As though she said, Thou knowest not what it is to reign, command and entreat not." So the margin of the Geneva Bible then is being used there by the Geneva translators to explain to the English reader what that literal Hebrew what? Meant. Okay? Okay. And then you get the English, let's look at the New English Bible there. "Are you or are you not king in Israel?" Does that have the same? Okay. The gist is the same, but the force of it is, I think, flattened out. And so does Hammond. "These notes, constantly explaining and interpreting, have a significant effect upon the nature of the translation, because the translators could always use them to clear up ambiguities, explain obscurities, and fill in ellipses. It meant that the actual translation could afford to retain, to a great degree, the ambiguities, obscurities, and ellipses of the original. While the margin is specific and discursive, the text can stand as an evocatively simple rendering of the Hebrew images and metaphors." In other words, can they keep the Hebrew text largely intact because they feel they can use the margin to explain it? Okay? So, the above comments from the pen of the above comments are from the pen of Hammond. I would like to add and conclude with the following from Professor Daniel. So this would be Professor David Daniel, author of The Bible in English. Notice what he says. "In the Geneva Old Testament, there are more notes in the poetic and prophetic books than in the narrative histories and laws." So what does that mean? That means if you take this 1560 Geneva Bible, the Old Testament, and you compare, so let me just find a page in Psalms so that you can see what he's talking. So here's Nehemiah, here's Psalms. Is it jam-packed with marginal notes? Okay? So if you take the work here and you look at it statistically, so in the Geneva Old Testament there are more notes in the poetic and prophetic books, so that would be Job, through Song of Solomon, and then the prophets, right? There are more notes in the poetic and prophetic books than in the narrative histories and laws. Here the Geneva translators show two, advantages. First, the sheer strangeness of Hebrew poetry needs interpretive help if it is to mean anything in English. And they have felt free to use whatever kind of comment is best. Sometimes the literal meaning is in the text, a metaphor is in the margin, and sometimes the other way around. But in both cases, the strategy is made clear. Sometimes they use straight glossing, as in Isaiah 40, verse 6. All flesh is grass. All flesh is grass, and all the grace thereof is as the flower of the field. They note on that, meaning all man's wisdom and natural powers. So, in other words, when they say all the grace thereof is of the flower of the field, they're giving the interpretation, meaning all man's wisdom and natural powers. And then they give James chapter 1 verse 10, and they give 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 24. The verse in James is, quote, "Again, he that is rich, let him rejoice in that he is made low, for as the flower of grass shall vanish." And then in 1 Peter 1:24, "All flesh is as grass, and all the glory of men is as a flower of grass. The grass withereth and the flower fadeth away, but the word of the Lord endureth" what? So do you see what they just did? They took the verse in Isaiah 46, they attached a note of explanation, and then two cross references. Go see James 1:10 and go see 1 Peter 1:24. That's what they just did. And where did they do that? They did it in the margin. Okay? The later phrase picks up the words two verses later in the Isaiah chapter. It was and is a famous passage, much quoted, but the points should not be lost. For the Geneva translators, Scripture is a vast network of related phrases, particularly connecting the testaments, and this is wholly right, the New Testament alertness to the old being rich in every chapter. The King James panels deserve commendation in their frequent preservation of Geneva's richness of internal scriptural reference. The Geneva translators did not, of course, invent cross-referencing, but they developed it. The other advantage for their poetic and prophetic books is that the Geneva translators took the division into verses. Paragraphs suited Tyndale's excellent understanding of the Hebrew narrative drive. Hebrew poetry works differently. Considering the opening of Job chapter 38, approaching the climax of the unique poem. So why don't we get there? Why don't everybody get Job 38? So what he's saying, what Hammond is saying there is the following. Okay? If you are going to, let me see if I can find this for you. What passage is that?
Job
38. I haven't actually checked this out, so we'll see what happens. Okay, it's not gonna list it the way that I wanted it to, so we'll just get off that. Okay. So I'm gonna read it from the notes. In the notes you have the Geneva Bible rendering, and then if you find Job 38 verse 1, you can check it against how the King James handled the same passage. Okay, so let me just grab that quick. So, here is what the Geneva said. Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, any difference?
Small difference.
Any substantive difference?
No.
Verse 2. Who is this that darkeneth the counsel by words without knowledge? Okay. Verse 3. Gird up now thy loins like a man. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me. Verse 4. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Verse 5. Who hath laid the measures thereof? If thou knowest, or who hath stretched the line over it? Verse 6. Whereupon are the foundations thereof set? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? What's that? Okay. 7. When the stars of the morning praised me together, and all the children of God rejoiced. Okay. So, notice though, I want to show you this in the notes. Notice though how when you lay this out like this with verses, numberings, can you easily see how each line rhymes and relates to the previous line? Whereas if you mash this together in just one paragraph, you're going to miss some of that as far as the poetry is concerned. Okay? So let's read the last statement and we'll be done here. The complex and cumulative imagery, and above all the parallelisms, are more than weakened if this is printed as a paragraph. Moreover, this is God taking breath, as it were. To go on about his creation for 4 long chapters, a total of 126 splendid verses. The immediate establishment of a rhythmic base is essential. The King James panels understood this and took over the first 6 verses, the first 6 verses unchanged, apart from changing set in verse 6 to fastened. What they did change, however, in verse 7 produces pure magic, when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy. The Geneva margin notes their own version of the latter phrase, the children of God, meaning the angels. Okay? So the point here is that this structure that the King James finds little to change here, and when they do change, what they do change, they alter for the better, right? So the main change there is in verse 7. When the stars of the morning praised me together, and all the children of God rejoiced, right? What does the King James say there in verse 7? When the morning stars sang together, and the sons of God shouted for joy. Man, that just sounds good, doesn't it? I think so too. And when they have a marginal note on the phrase children of God here in verse 7, in the margin, they explain and define the children of God as meaning who? Angels. So again, the King James says in verse 7, when the sons of God, when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for what? Joy. Okay? So, the point here, is there clearly a link between the Geneva Bible and the King James? Yeah, like a strong link. So, in the places where the King James elected to alter the bishop's Bible reading, the majority of the time, the substituted reading came from which Bible?
Geneva.
Okay? And this all starts with the 1560. Now, this is going to end our discussion of the Old Testament. We've talked about a lot of things here, probably more detail than you wanted, maybe. I don't know. But then in the next where we're going to go next week is we're going to comment briefly on the New Testament, and then we have to talk about the theology of the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible. If we don't talk about the theology of the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible, then you're going to misunderstand in part why King James authorized the King James Bible. Because it has a lot to do with the marginal notes that the king objected to. Okay? So we'll get into all that next time. Thanks for attention. I'm going to close down the live.